and Africa. One perfect example, which he highlights in his new book, is an Indian company called Mahindra and Mahindra, known as M&M in India. The firm specializes in small, inexpensive tractors, perfect for poor Indian farmers toiling on small plots of land. As its business boomed, M&M began looking at the U.S. market. It saw an open niche there. Hobby farmers, landscapers, and home contractors, customers who were not being served by the enormous agribusiness size machines produced by U.S. tractor giant John Deere. It's this kind of adaptability that Govindarajan says sets apart these reverse innovators from the competition. And those U.S. firms who've joined them, he says, have learned to set aside everything they think they know about customers in poor countries and approach new emerging markets with a clean slate attitude. Today in The Exchange, we explore this concept of reverse innovation with Professor Vijay Govindarajan, and let's hear from you too. Are you a business owner? Have you explored growing your company in developing nations? Have you traveled to some of these countries and seen this reverse innovation our guest has seen? Do you agree that this could be the new business model, or are you worried about its implications for this country? The Exchange number for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Professor Govindarajan joins us from Dartmouth College. And Professor, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Well, that story of tractor maker M&M is a great one from the book. But there's a much earlier example that I'd love for you to give us that a lot of our listeners will recognize. Tell us the story of Gatorade. That's an early story of reverse innovation.
You see, people know about Gatorade as a mother of all soft drinks. And a couple of researchers in the University of Florida, they were looking for a way to rehydrate their football players. And they concocted this Gatorade. But the origin of it really goes back to Bangladesh. In the early part of the 20th century, there was a outbreak of cholera in Bangladesh. And the way to treat cholera patients is to keep them hydrated,
right,
because of diarrhea. And the Western doctors who went to Bangladesh, they were surprised that the local treatment for really rehydrating was giving the patient carbohydrate and sugar. And the Western medical knowledge at that time was if you put carbohydrate in the stomach of people, it worsens the diarrhea. But actually, it worked. And that was written up in a British journal. And the University of Florida researchers read that article, and that gave them the inspiration to come up with Gatorade. So this is a classic example of reverse innovation.
Well, I love that story, because who knew that Gatorade came from Bangladesh? So I don't want to get into this too much, but it was a mixture of what, like coconut water and smashed bananas and a couple other things, right?
Exactly. And it's got carbohydrate, sugar, sodium, calcium, all those things. And the researchers obviously built on that knowledge and concocted this drink.
Well, and let's talk about then the traditional patterns of innovation, and then we'll get into the reversal and how and when and why. You know, you've written, Professor, it seems to make so much sense that wealthy countries would be the main innovators of the world. I mean, they've got all the advantages. They've got the universities and the infrastructure and the venture capital and all the things that help fuel research and innovation. So just remind us first what that traditional pattern is, and then we'll talk about how you say it's being turned on its head.
You see, that traditionally, what we did was multinationals innovated in a rich country like the U.S. and sold those products all over the world, including poor countries, because this makes logical sense, as you say, Laura, because we have got the best people here, we got the best educational institutions, and most importantly, we have customers who can buy these products. So it's logical that innovation started in a rich country like the U.S. Now, reverse innovation is obviously doing the opposite, and we can talk about why that is a phenomenon that's happening now.
Well, then let's talk about it then. I mean, there's that old phrase, necessity is the mother of invention. And what's so interesting for me in this book is that you see in countries that have maybe poor water systems or unreliable electricity or really poor roads, these hardships have fueled innovation.
Without a question. You know, think of it this way. Let's take a simple statistics. If you take the world's population it's 7 billion, of which 5.8 billion live in poor countries. Now, incidentally, when I'm using the word rich and poor countries, I'm not making any value judgments here. This is just simple World Bank definition. If you take the average GDP per capita in the world and draw a line, any country below the average is called a poor country. And according to that definition, there are 160 poor countries. And their population is 5.8 billion. That means there are 5.8 billion consumers there. And on top of that, their GDP total is $30 trillion. So this is a big, giant economy. But to capture that opportunity, you need to innovate, because think of one simple statistics. In India, the average GDP per capita is $1,000. In the U.S., the GDP per capita income is $50,000. So there is no business model you created for middle America, where the mass market per capita income is $50,000. You can go and simply adapt and hope to capture middle India, where the mass market per capita income is $1,000. The point here is, in the U.S., there is one person, imagine, with $1,000 to spend. In India, there are 1,000 people, each have a dollar to spend. The total consumption is still $1,000, but the underlying demand structure is dramatically different. That's where you need to innovate.
So you need to dramatically change the way you market, the products you make, to serve those 5.8 billion poor people. How do companies, though, Professor Govindarajan, decide whether it's worth it? I mean, if I'm a U.S. company, I'm thinking, you know, there's no profit margin for me there.
Yeah. Clearly, the business model has to be ultra low cost, but that does not mean it is not profitable. Actually, it can be extremely profitable given the volumes. But not only that, if American companies don't do this, just as you gave the example of Mahindra and Mahindra, local companies in these poor countries will do the innovation. And guess what? They will bring those innovations into the U.S. and disrupt U.S. companies. And we have seen this happen in the 70s and 80s when Japanese automakers came and disrupted the big three in Detroit. And that is nothing compared to the kind of competition we are likely to face from India, China, continent of Africa, Brazil, etc.
Well, and I didn't mention at the beginning that M&M, the tractor company that built the little tractors in India, ended up being the world's biggest tractor maker. So, you know, it isn't just enough to say, well, they're making little tractors for small Indian farmers and we don't need to worry about that.
Without a question, you know, let me give you an example. You know, in the U.S., we think about the healthcare industry in the U.S. We spend too much money. It's very high cost. And even after spending all this money, we cannot guarantee universal access. We leave 60 million Americans out of healthcare. And even after spending all this money, we cannot guarantee world-class quality. So the conversation in the U.S. is about how do we dramatically reduce our healthcare costs while still giving world-class quality and providing universal coverage. And guess what? There are experiments going on right now in poor countries where the healthcare model is predicated on ultra-low cost, world-class quality, universal access. One simple example is there is a hospital in Bangalore called NH Hospital. It's a cardiac hospital which does cardiac surgery for $2,000. In the U.S., probably cardiac surgeries will cost $50,000 and above.
Wow, big and difference.
That is a big difference, and the difference doesn't mean the quality is bad in India, because you can't do poor quality heart surgery. And actually, one measure of quality is mortality rate 30 days after surgery. For this hospital in Bangalore, their mortality rate 30 days after surgery is 1.2%. The U.S. average is 2%. So their quality is on par, maybe even better. And on top of that, they make 35% gross margin, even though they charge only $2,000. And did I tell you that they don't deny care for anybody? So they give universal access. In fact, 60% of the patients, they don't charge at all. If you can't pay, they do it free. Only for the 40% of the patients, they charge $2,000 and still make 35% margin. And they build a new hospital every 3 years from internally generated profits. In fact, the person who started is Devi Shetty. He is a personal cardiac surgeon for Mother Teresa. That's where he got the inspiration to provide universal access to high-quality care at ultra-low cost. this is the kind of business model we ought to be adopting in the U.S. And guess what? Dave Shetty is actually building a 2,000-bed hospital in Cayman Islands, just as we are talking, and which will become operational on 1st January 2013, just to serve, because Cayman Islands is a 60-minute flight from Miami. It's designed to serve American patients at a fraction of the cost that we pay for cardiac surgery in this country. So for medical tourism, why should Americans go to India? Let us bring India to America.
Wow.
This is classic reverse innovation.
Well, a lot more to talk about, and I want to invite our listeners to join us as well. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Join us with your questions and comments about reverse innovation today. Our guest is Dartmouth professor and co-author of this book, Vijay Govindarajan. And real quick, Professor, you keep mentioning India, and you mentioned earlier China. Some people don't think those are developing countries or poor countries. They think, hey, they're competing for our jobs. They're doing fine.
In fact, I'm using the word developing and developed economies based on the World Bank definition of GDP per capita. When you think about those countries, their GDP per capita is still way below what we will consider as the average.
All right. Just wanted to clear that up. And we will start taking your calls after a short break. The number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. Also, we're on Facebook. We hope you go to our page. Join the conversation there. We'll be right back.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and more on a new book on reverse innovation on the exchange on NHPR. And at 10 o'clock on the Diane Rehm Show, House Republicans take aim at Attorney General Eric Holder. New Hampshire weather, we have another day of heat advisories for New Hampshire for this afternoon and early evening. For today, hazy sunshine, hot and humid, highs from 94 to 100 degrees. Tonight, partly cloudy, warm, muggy, lows from 65 degrees from northern Coos County, ranging to around 75 degrees along the Massachusetts border. Support for NHPR comes from UR members, and support also comes to us from Maine, Cernota, and Reardon. Patent attorneys for companies that believe intellectual property is the business of the future. Maine, Cernota, and Reardon on the web at mcr-ip.com. And from Tully Volkswagen in Nashua, presenting the all-new 2012 Volkswagen Passat, offering a top safety rating of up to 43 miles per gallon. Details on Facebook or at tullyvw.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, we're exploring the concept of reverse innovation with Dartmouth professor and author Vijay Govindarajan. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. If you're a business owner, have you thought about expanding your firm into developing nations, these emerging markets that the professor talks about? Why or why not? Have you traveled in the developing world and seen some of this reverse innovation that our guest talks about? Do you agree that reverse innovation could be a new business model, or do you think it might represent a threat to American businesses? Our number for you to join us with your questions, thoughts, and comments is 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Govindarajan, before we go to the phones, I did want to pick up on that hospital example that you gave. You were talking about a hospital in India that specializes intensely in cardiac surgery, charging $2,000 per patient versus $50,000, which is what you'd pay in this country. I have to ask you, how do they do it?
The magic is innovation. You see, their quality, as I said, is on par with the U.S. quality. That means they are buying the same equipment that you're going to see in Mass General or Mayo Clinic. That's how they assure world-class quality. Then how do they dramatically bring down the cost? They use their equipment 100 times more, 500 times more than what we do in the U.S. If you use the same equipment 500 times more, the cost per patient comes down.
Sure.
Isn't this not what we learned in manufacturing 101 in
right.
this country? This is how we run the Ford Motor. Ford Motor will run its factory this way. They will identify their critical resource and then use it 100% of the time. Essentially, what this hospital in Bangalore is doing is following principles that we have found for industrial organizations, economies of scale, mass production. So they're mass producing healthcare. Now, we always think somehow when you mass produce healthcare, the quality has to suffer. I ask the question, when we mass produce hamburgers, nobody complains about bad quality. When we mass produce cars, nobody complains about bad quality. What is so special about healthcare? Actually, when you mass produce healthcare, quality improves. Why? Because their surgeons do so much surgery, they know all the complications. And also think of it this way. Suppose there are 10 different types of heart surgery. Because of high volumes, they can ask a surgeon in this hospital in India to specialize in one of those 10 surgeries. When you specialize, you become very good at it. This is, again, a principle from manufacturing. And whereas in the U.S., we way underutilize our critical resource. You can go to a big hospital in the U.S., go to their imaging center, you will have a $1 million X-ray machine sitting there, $2 million CAT scanner, $3 million MR machine, and they will be utilized 10 to 15% of the time. They are lying idle for 80 to 90% of the time. Somehow we believe in the U.S. we have a birthright to have that CAT scanner available when we need it. I ask why? If Ford Motor Company would run its factory that way, keeping its most critical resource 90% idle, will we tolerate that inefficiency? So basically the idea here is we have got to dramatically rethink our healthcare delivery model. That's what this hospital in Bangalore is doing because they don't know anything more about medical science. Their surgeons don't know anything more about cardiac surgery than what we know in the U.S. How come they're able to do it and offer it to so many patients at a dramatically lower price point? We really need to rethink our healthcare delivery in this country.
Well, and we could do a whole hour on that. But the book is not just about healthcare, obviously, lots of manufactured products and consumer products where companies have really come up with innovative ways to reach emerging markets, American companies and foreign companies. And I want to ask you about something you mentioned earlier. You said U.S. companies need to innovate to sell to poor countries. They can't just make the same stuff, export it, assume people in poor countries will buy it. You said they need to do this or they'll basically get beaten at their own game, like John Deere did by Mahindra & Mahindra. What's the broader picture here, though? I mean, you know, that's fine for individual companies. They need to think about this. But what does understanding and appreciating reverse innovation mean for the whole larger U.S. economy?
I think it has got tremendous implications. Post-2008-2009 financial crisis, we have found that the rich countries are going to grow very slow. And in the U.S., the growth is slow. And right now, we are having a major crisis in Europe. And any crisis in Europe also will have a huge continued impact on the U.S. going forward. That means in the rich world, certainly America belongs in the rich world, we are in very, very tough times. In very, very tough times, reverse innovation is the answer for two important reasons. First, America, if you want to grow, we need to go where the growth is, and the growth is in these poor countries. So America has to participate in these poor countries and their economic growth for America to grow, because America itself, in the domestic consumption, there is severe constraints. The second is, if America and American companies don't pay attention to these poor countries, as we talked about the Mahindra and Mahindras and the cardiac hospitals of the world will bring their business models into the U.S. So already we are hurting, and actually the disruption will be even more severe from these local companies. My point is, think about why is Walmart so successful in the U.S.? Because U.S. is ready for very good quality products at an affordable price, because we are entering a different era. The good old days are gone. We have to really focus on how do we conserve our resources? How do we give Americans high quality products at an affordable price? And these are the kinds of business models that will come from poor countries. Therefore, reverse innovation has a huge impact for building a great America. We have got to be curious about problems of people in poor countries, just as we are curious about problems of people in rich countries.
Well, and I want to ask you about that curiosity in just a minute. But our number here on the exchange again for you to join us with your questions and comments is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR, or email us, exchange@nhpr.org. Join us with your comments or questions about this concept of reverse innovation that we're talking about at 1-800-892-6477. So again, to answer the question, why should Americans be interested in this? You're saying from an offensive standpoint, you need to sell to these 5.8 billion people. From a defensive standpoint, you need to make sure that scrappy, innovative companies in China or Mexico don't come here and beat us at our own game.
Without a question. And also, you know, think of it this way. You know, poor countries lack infrastructure. And because they lack infrastructure, actually they leapfrog. And we have seen this happen in the telecommunications industry. You know, you go to Morocco or any poor country, their cellular telephones work a lot better than in New Hampshire or Vermont. So because they don't have any landlines, they skip to the next generation of technology. And guess what? Because they skip to the next generation of technology in telecommunications, they are also able to offer services that are built on that technology, like mobile banking is taking off like gangbusters in a country like Kenya. So they are leading in services that are built on those technologies as well. And those services and those innovations are needed in countries like UK or US going forward.
Yeah, that's real interesting. And I did hear about how cell phone technology, cell phone banking, is more robust in countries like Kenya than they might be here. What are other examples of that? Sort of because they don't have the basic infrastructure from 50 or 100 years ago, they are leapfrogging, as you say. Are there other examples in the book?
Without a question. You know, you take a flight from Beijing to New York and compare the airport infrastructure, and you sometimes wonder which is the developing country and which is the developed country. Because the JFK airport, because we have an existing one and which has been built, which has got a lot of useful life left, it's not cutting edge. It's not latest. Whereas a country like China is building new airports, they build the latest and the greatest. But even a bigger example is in the energy area. Because in the U.S., we are stuck with an energy infrastructure we built 100 years ago, which is based on fossil fuel. When fossil fuel was plenty and cheap, we put central power plants and then put a national grid to distribute that power plant, to distribute that electricity all over the U.S. Whereas if you think of a country like India, 90% of India does not have any transmission lines. So the question of replicating this energy infrastructure in India doesn't even arise. Therefore, India is not looking for central power plants, but they are looking for decentralized power generation, which demands looking at renewables. So countries like India and China will be powered with sun and wind because they don't have existing energy infrastructure to obsolete. And renewable technologies are going to be important for the U.S. going forward, but right now we are constrained by our current infrastructure. Therefore, this is another good example. We have a lot of infrastructure in the U.S. That's both an asset and a liability for us. Whereas in poor countries, lack of infrastructure, they leapfrog, whether it is transportation, energy, water, cell phones, mobile banking, you name it. They will move forward.
Interesting. What you call sort of legacy infrastructure, right? And they don't have that. So, boom, just move on beyond that. You know, I wanted to ask you, though, Professor, this trend of reverse innovation, how, if at all, is it linked to the often heard concern that U.S. multinationals are outsourcing jobs to these booming developing nations like India, China, Brazil, or Mexico? I mean, you've talked about the benefits to American business and the American economy, but is there a drawback? Are we going to lose more jobs overseas?
This is not about outsourcing to India. This is about innovating for India. There is a fundamental difference. The outsourcing movement started when we essentially sent jobs to India to produce products cheaper for the American consumer. That's what outsourcing was. This is about innovating for India. And this is actually going to create growth and jobs in the U.S. And that's what we need to understand. Because when you're creating innovation for India, many of the components for those innovations will come from the U.S. Therefore, this is in collaboration with jobs in the U.S., you are also creating innovation for India. But more importantly, the innovations from India will subsequently come back into the U.S. where you will be actually manufacturing and selling those products in the U.S., thereby creating additional jobs. And put it this way, if U.S. companies don't do it, our jobs will get subtracted, just like the way Japanese brought their low-cost automobiles and disrupted and destroyed jobs in Detroit. So therefore, this is both for offensive and offense and defense reasons. Job creation will be better if we are curious about the poor world.
Again, our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. Join us, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our guest is Professor Vijay Govindarajan. He's at Dartmouth. He's co-author with Chris Trimble of a new book called Reverse Innovation, Create Far From Home, Win Everywhere. We'd love your thoughts. If you're a business owner, have you thought about expanding into some of these poorer countries? Why or why not? If you've traveled extensively in the developing world, have you seen some of this leapfrogging and reverse innovation that the professor talks about? Do you agree that reverse innovation is a winner for this country, or are you concerned about what it might mean for American business? Our number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You know, Professor, we've talked a lot on this program about the skills gap and how not enough American students are studying science and engineering, while students from abroad are only too happy to fill those slots in those programs at our colleges. How do you see this trend fitting into reverse innovation? Is this part of the fuel fueling this trend?
Absolutely. When you stop to think about it, when you want to innovate for India, innovate for China, innovate for consumers in the continent of Africa, you have to also tap into the local talent pool. Today, India and China are producing more engineers than probably the entire rich world combined. So there is a lot of very talented people there, and they are not necessarily migrating to the U.S. Because the opportunities in these poor countries are enormous. So for American companies, when you want to innovate for India, innovate for China, you can actually tap into that local talent pool, which is enormous advantage.
Is this something you think Americans should worry about, though? You know, our own people should be studying science and engineering.
I think that's a very good point, Laura, that you're bringing up. Reverse innovation shouldn't be pursued in exclusion to innovating in America for America. We are not talking about either or.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, Americans, because I do worry a little bit about whether we are not putting the emphasis on science and technology that we should. Therefore, we must encourage science and technology education in this country. We must innovate because the whole country is based on innovation. So we must rekindle the spirit of innovation for the American consumer. So we need to continue to do this. But this is just an additional growth opportunity.
And you've said that this is important when you're going to innovate for China. You don't want to hire somebody who was, you know, born in New Hampshire, lived in New Hampshire his whole life. You want somebody who understands Chinese needs, Chinese desires, and the Chinese market. Let's take some calls if we could, Professor. Our phone number is 1-800-892-6477. And up first is Sasha in Keene. Hi, Sasha. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. I'd like to say, first of all, that I live in Africa most of the time, and I agree by and large with the professor, but I would like to mention that I think he's leaving one major thing out of the argument in order to make it stronger, and I think it would be best at least to acknowledge it, which is labor costs. In Bangalore, for example, a nurse might get paid $2,500 a year. The guys who work on the building of the building are paid $1,000 a year. These kind of costs can't be innovated out of in the United States. And I think that should be at least mentioned.
You know, then Sasha, go ahead. Yeah.
Sorry. Then I had one more comment, and then I'll get off rather than discussing. At least in Africa, there are actually sort of cultural incentives against this kind of innovation. And I think that's probably not true in India, which is one reason so many things are happening there. In Africa, a lot of the time, the things that are considered modern and therefore good are things that come from the West. So local innovation, in some ways, is almost discouraged by the market, which wants the products that carry cachet as well as value from overseas. So these kind of intermediate industries that the professor is mentioning don't do that well. Even if they can provide something for a much lower cost, those products don't carry the cachet of the externally produced goods produced in Europe or the West or wherever it is.
You know, Sasha, two great points. Thank you so much. And quickly to the first one, you know, I was going to ask you too, and I didn't, and I should have. As you were talking about the healthcare example from India, I was wondering, what about the doctors? I mean, I'm guessing they don't make as much as U.S. doctors make.
Absolutely. I think both the points he is making are extremely good points. Certainly, the price point difference between a product heart surgery here for $50,000 versus India $2,000 is certainly explained by labor cost differences. But that doesn't explain this dramatic difference. Certainly, the surgeons in India don't get paid the same as surgeons in the U.S. But that doesn't explain this dramatic difference in price point. Bulk of the explanation is really innovation. And the beauty is when American companies go into these poor countries, they can actually also leverage the low labor costs and thereby benefit from innovation.
All right, and we'll pick up on Sasha's other point, which was really a good one, about the bias toward Western products in some African countries in his experience. So pick up on that after a short break. We'll keep taking your calls, too. Join us, 1-800-892-6477.
Ginger Lever is with UNH Manchester, an NHPR underwriter.
Supporting NHPR is very effective for any kind of organization that wants to connect with an audience because people listen. If you go into restaurants or walking by people's cars in the parking lot, you can hear it. And that's a measure and a testimony to the fact that people are listening.
For more information about becoming an NHPR underwriter, visit the business support page on nhpr.org.
Support for NHPR comes from You Are Members and from the Justin Morrill Symposium, August 11th and 12th in Stratford, Vermont, exploring the Land-Grant College Act and education in the 21st century, morrillhomestead.org. And from Golf and Ski Warehouse with stores in Hudson, Greenland, and West Lebanon, New Hampshire, and also in Scarborough, Maine, online at golfandskiwarehouse.com. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, it's time for our annual Summer Book Show. Email us your favorite new books for summer at exchange@nhpr.org. And be sure to join us tomorrow morning live at 9 for this annual favorite program. Today, we're talking about reverse innovation, how technological advances in developing countries are affecting American businesses. Join us with your questions and comments, 1-800-892-6477. Like our last caller, if you've spent significant time in the developing world, have you seen some of this reverse innovation that our guest talks about? Do you see some of the benefits that he mentions for American businesses and for the American economy? Are you a little worried about reverse innovation? Also, if you're a business owner, have you thought about expanding into this huge, huge market that he talks about of 5.8 billion people in poor countries? Have you thought about growing your business there? Our number one more time, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. And Professor Govindarajan, let's pick up on Sasha's second point, which I thought was so interesting. He said in Africa, he said cultural incentives are against homegrown innovation, that there's a bias towards anything modern has to be from the West. It has a more of a cachet. People there look down on, again, homegrown technological or otherwise innovations. He thinks India is very different. What do you think?
Actually, that's an excellent point. This is the way I would put it. Even in India, there is probably 10% of the economic pyramid would want world-class quality products produced by multinationals from the rich countries because they associate quality and brand in that way. But my point is the remaining 90% of India wants world-class quality but at an affordable price. Essentially, they don't want poor quality products. They don't want shoddy products. This is not about low cost, because poor people don't want inferior products. They want good quality products at an affordable price. Because the point that I'm saying is, if you think of the 7 billion population in the world, today corporations essentially serve 2 billion out of the 7 billion and have left the remaining 5 billion to charity to take care of. I think this is an outmoded thinking. We have to bring the 5 billion poor into the consuming base. And when you want to bring the 5 billion poor into the consuming base, you can't give them the products the 2 billion rich are consuming. And poor people don't want inferior products. Even in Africa, perhaps he is right, maybe there is a cultural bias, but even in Africa, if you provide the poor person with quality product at an affordable price, why would they not want that?
Well, again, Sasha, thanks for the call. And the number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about scrappy startup companies in developing countries, but the book does talk a lot about American multinationals that have successfully used reverse innovation. But you also write that it's really hard for them to get there at times. There's a whole bunch of assumptions they just have to park at the door. Give us some of the top assumptions that you find American business leaders entering in this really just have to get rid of before they can even get started.
You see, Laura, the biggest problem for American companies is not technology, not resources, not people. Actually, American companies have enormous resources. They have the best technology. They have the smartest people. But yet, in my research, what I have found is American multinationals struggle in emerging markets despite all these advantages. And my research, what I have found is the problem is really mindset. Problem is really organization, what I call the dominant logic. The dominant logic is the way you have competed in the past. And the structures and the systems and the people and the processes that you have created, American companies have been so successful in the U.S. serving rich world customers, their very success becomes their problem. And if they use the American logic to unlock these poor countries, they get into enormous difficulties. Let me give you one simple example. You know, there is this company, Kellogg, which is a very famous company in the breakfast cereal market. In
fact, yes.
I had cornflakes today morning before coming to the show. And they have world-class brands, whether it's cornflakes or Rice Krispies, etc. But they are essentially a very marginal player in India, which is perhaps the fastest-growing breakfast market in the world. And the question is why? And in their minds, Kellogg already thinks they have innovated for India because they have regular cornflakes in India, then they make banana cornflakes, then they make mango cornflakes. They think they have already innovated. But the problem is, those of us who have been gone to India are familiar with how Indians eat breakfast, they like to eat hot breakfast. So you pour hot milk on your cereal. I don't care whether it is plain cornflakes or banana cornflakes or mango cornflakes. It becomes a mush.
Hasn't somebody told them that?
In fact, I'm pretty sure somebody in India, because they have an operation in India, probably people in India have already told the head office, our cornflakes is not working in India. But the problem is, because they don't have power to decide, because the decision-making power still rests in the U.S., people in the U.S. are probably saying, well, small amount of sales revenue in India today is okay. Once Indians become more civilized, they will come to our conflicts. And my point is, when they see a small sales revenue in India, they don't want to invest $100 million to come up with a conflict which will work with hot milk. My point is, because they see small sales revenue in India today, they don't invest. Because they don't invest, that revenue never becomes big. Then they say, I told you so.
It's a vicious cycle, isn't it?
It's a vicious cycle. Therefore, to break out of this cycle, break out of this dominant logic, if you really want to win in poor countries, you must shift resources. You must shift decision-making power. You must empower the local teams to really understand customer problem. That's the mindset change is perhaps the biggest change.
You know, it's interesting, though. I wonder if there are cultural or mindset issues on the other side. I mean, is it all that Americans are sort of, not curious about what people in developing countries really want? Or is it a two-way street here, Professor? I mean, are there some sort of cultural biases, good or bad, against what American innovators are trying to do? You know what I'm saying? I'm wondering if it's more of a two-way street here.
It may well be a two-way street, Laura, but the point is, if American companies have to capture this opportunity, we really have to become more curious.
The 5.8 billion people. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, because we have to almost assume we landed on Mars, and we know nothing about conflicts, we know nothing about heart surgery, we know nothing about housing, we know nothing about energy, and simply recreate it. It's almost, I would say, go back to the very spirit of America. You know, when you think about it, 100 years ago, there was a gentleman by the name of Mr. Henry Ford who said, why can't they make a simple automobile, good quality automobile, but a simple one, called Model T, and which wouldn't have power steering, which wouldn't have air conditioning, but it's only $600. Suddenly a whole market opened up. Or even as late as the early 80s, when computers were sold for hundreds of thousands of dollars, only rich folks in the U.S. could afford it, a gentleman by name Steve Jobs came and said, why can't they make a computer for $1,000? Every mom, every child can afford one. My point is, we need to go back to our own roots of how we innovated in a very fundamental way. And we need to take that clean slate mindset when we go into these poor countries.
Well, it's interesting, too, what you mentioned was that often companies run into trouble because the headquarters is still in the U.S. and the people at those headquarters think, yeah, India or China, but we know better. You have an example in the book about Walmart ran into this problem in Mexico and Latin America where it just wasn't fitting with the local culture. And Walmart said, you know what? We're going to look at what local people really want and we're going to dramatically change what we do. This is another great example of reverse innovation from the book. Why don't you tell us about that, Professor Govindarajan?
Because when Walmart went into countries like Mexico or Brazil or Argentina, they first thought of taking their business model from the U.S., which is the big box model. But when you think about a country like Mexico, first of all, these are poor people. So they can't buy a truckload of laundry detergent or toilet paper, etc., because then they are inventorying all these things. They don't have enough money to keep them at home. Second, most of them in a country like Mexico, they go shopping either on bicycle or walk, or they take public transportation. So there is a limit to what they can carry.
Right.
So this big box model simply does not work. So Walmart tried small store formats in these countries. And even though the format is a small store, Walmart is still getting enormous economies of scale at the back end because with the suppliers, they can still buy bulk even though the format of the store is small. So they were successful in these countries. Guess what? In the last 24 months, they are bringing the small store format into the U.S. Because when you think of, say, a city like New York or Chicago, the real estate is too expensive to put a very big store. And therefore, a small format makes sense there. Or if you think of a very small rural area in the U.S., it's not big enough to sustain a big Walmart store, but you can have a small store and still are able to offer the products at a lower price because you're still getting very good relationship with the suppliers. You're able to procure these products at a lower cost. Here is a classic example of reverse innovation starting in Mexico or Brazil, coming back in the U.S.
Right. So they were open-minded enough to innovate for that Mexican and Latin American market, and lo and behold, it helped them in the United States.
Absolutely.
There are obstacles, though, I wonder, when U.S. firms try and do this abroad. I mean, you know, you've got lots of great examples in the book of when it worked out, but They often sometimes run against corrupt governments, regulations that have a strong bias toward local providers, even the fear that your innovation might be quickly copied by local providers. So it's not a sure and guaranteed path to success, Professor, I'm guessing. I mean, it works a lot of the time, but might not work all the time.
You're absolutely right. In some sense, we don't want to overhype emerging markets because that's a mistake. It's not like a gold mine there that you go there and get. But sometimes we also, right now, for instance, the economic growth in China has slowed down. The economic growth in India has slowed down. So many of the American CEOs that I talk to suddenly want to pull back their investment in India or China. That is a mistake also. We don't want to overreact on the other side. Maybe the truth is somewhere in between. These are very, very difficult markets to win because the conditions there, as you say, are not as ideal for business as we find in the U.S. Customers are different. Infrastructure is different. The problems are different. So these are difficult markets to capture. But if that is what great companies do, they take on challenging tasks. And if we can step up and meet this challenge, the benefits are enormous.
You know, we're talking to a New Hampshire audience largely, although we have great listeners in Maine, Massachusetts, and Vermont. And a lot of the businesses here are small to medium-sized businesses. And some of them may be wondering, okay, well, that's great for PepsiCo or Walmart or General Electric, but what about your sort of small to medium-sized business here in New Hampshire? Should they even bother seeking new customers in Africa and Asia and Latin America, or is it just too much trouble?
I would say there are two ways by which you can really benefit from reverse innovation, even if you're a very small company. The first is you don't actually have to go to Africa to innovate, but just be curious. Even if you're going on a vacation in Africa, just look around and see, are there some innovations going on in these countries you can actually adapt for America? Just being curious. Read about other countries, and when you're visiting, just be curious and keep your antenna up so that you just pick up some ideas. That's one way you can actually, this is like the Gatorade. You just pick up an idea that happens in Bangladesh and then incorporate it and develop it, even if you're a small business operating only in New Hampshire. The second approach I would say is, many times in poor countries, it does not take a lot of resources to actually do the innovation. Therefore, if you're a small company, what you don't have is resources. Therefore, actually doing innovation in the U.S., it takes more resources than doing an innovation in Brazil. But the key there is to find a local partner. You cannot do it yourself. So if you're a small businessman in New Hampshire, try to target a country that you feel comfortable. Maybe it is Mexico, maybe it is Brazil, and find a local partner with whom you can collaborate and create the innovation. If you don't want to do that, at least be just curious about poor countries. You'll get great ideas.
So if you don't have that local partner, you end up selling soggy cornflakes and nobody wants them. Based on your other example. Well, the book's been out for just a couple months, not long, just so far at this point. What sort of a reaction has it received?
I think the reaction has been phenomenal, partly because the timing is so right. As I pointed out, we are entering a slow growth world. What are the new growth norms in a slow growth world? And one of the ways you can grow is by innovating for poor countries, because that's where the growth is. And we need to follow where the growth is. And the key here is also think of it this way. This is also a wonderful thing for America to do, because ultimately a strong Africa is not just good for Africa, it's good for the U.S. So we need to think about how do we promote economic development amongst these 5 billion poor. And social justice is at the heart of world peace, it's at the heart of economic development in the U.S. Therefore, I say this principle of reverse innovation is such a good principle to embrace. That's why the reception for the book is being very, very strong. And I will put it this way. If you take 100 poor people at random and 100 rich people at random, there is no difference. Poor people have the same desire as the rich. Poor people have the same ambition as the rich. Poor people have the same needs as the rich. Why can't they have the same opportunity? This is the idea behind reverse innovation.
Well, Professor, it's been great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much, Laura.
That's Vijay Govindarajan. Again, he's a professor at Dartmouth College, a management consultant, and co-author with Chris Trimble of Reverse Innovation, Create Far From Home, Win Everywhere. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our interns are Tim Camerato and Claudia Camerino. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange is now on Facebook. Become a fan of our Facebook page. You can learn more about upcoming shows, what we're planning, get extra links and material. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our annual summer book show. Heavy hitters from Richard Ford to John Irving have new offerings. There are books on Bruce Springsteen, James Joyce, and the Obamas. And as the weather warms, lots of people are reading the steamy pages of 50 Shades of Grey. We'll look at the books you'll want to take with you to the beach, the mountains, or just lounging in your backyard. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange. Tomorrow morning, live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.